Today on the Inland Journal podcast, 44 years after the end of the Vietnam War, many people are still dealing with its aftermath. Some of them gathered in Spokane last weekend for the national convention of the group Veterans for Peace. They were there to talk about their common issues and to share their news about their respective work. They led workshops, posted art exhibits, played musical performances, and they told stories, lots of them. A man named Chuck Searcy flew in from Hanoi, Vietnam. He's an American. He served in the military intelligence unit in the Vietnam War in 1967 and 68.
Like most of the guys in my unit, within a very short time, I really turned against the war. When I left in June of 1968, I felt that it was one of the most tragic mistakes America had ever made. So when I came home, eventually I got involved in the anti-war movement. With Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Almost 25 years later, Searcy found himself tied to Vietnam again.
When I came back to Vietnam in 1992 with an old Army buddy as a tourist, and we traveled the country. Vietnam was in dire straits at that time. They were still trying to recover from the war, desperately struggling to regain some normalcy. The U.S. embargo was in place, and Vietnam was really suffering. And during that trip, I found the reception, the welcome from the Vietnamese, the warmth, incredible. There was no hostility toward us as former American GIs. And I decided I wanted to come back to Vietnam and try to help the Vietnamese in their recovery. I got the opportunity with a veterans organization, Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, in 1995, working on a project in Hanoi for disabled kids. And that evolved into my own awareness about the problem of bombs and mines and the fact that 100,000 Vietnamese had been killed or injured since the war ended in 1975. And from that awareness, another veterans organization, Vietnam Veterans Memorial Fund, and the government of Quang Tri Province, the former DMZ, came together and formed a partnership and decided to try to deal with this issue of bombs and mines, created Project Renew, which has been going on since then, reducing accidents, injuries, and trying to keep the people of Vietnam safe. The conventional approach is to wander around with a metal detector and find bombs and mines and grenades and destroy them. In 2008, after Project Renew had been working for a number of years, we entered into a very strong and constructive partnership with Norwegian People's Aid, an international organization based in Oslo. And together we changed direction. With NPA, we took a much more strategic approach to the problem, which consists of basically surveying local province, districts, communities, and villages, interviewing people and determining exactly the nature of the problem and the danger where it exists, comparing that with maps of old bombing runs that are provided to us by the U.S. Department of Defense, and basically pinpointing the problem and sending teams in to clean up the ordnance where there's no lack of efficiency or effectiveness. They go straight to where the problem is and resolve it. Together with that, we teach the kids, the children, and the adults, the farmers and others, the nature of the problem, how to identify various pieces of ordnance, different items of munitions, and how to be safe, and how to report it when they find it. So they notify these teams that then respond within 1 or 2 hours, and they destroy the ordnance. So together, that has not only cleaned up thousands of bombs over recent years, but it has also reduced the number of accidents, injuries, and that really is the goal. The goal is zero accidents, zero casualties. And we're moving in that direction very clearly. An example is the last 10-year period, 2008, in Quang Tri Province, there were 72 casualties, accidents, injuries, and deaths. 10 years later, in 2018, last year, for the first time since the war ended in 1975, there were zero accidents. This year, 2019, so far, zero accidents. And that really is the mark of success. The goal is to, we know we can't clean up every bomb and mine, but we can reduce and eliminate accidents and keep people safe. And that really is the model. Project Renew is the model for all of Vietnam. And it can be implemented, we think, in the next, within the next 5 to 10 years, it should be implemented throughout the country, and people can live with confidence that they are no longer facing this threat.
Chuck Searcy leads Project Renew in Vietnam. Not everyone working on Vietnam War-related projects served in the war. Heather Bowser is the daughter of a Vietnam vet. She says he was exposed to the defoliant Agent Orange, and she believes her physical issues are linked to that exposure.
I was born 2 months premature. I weighed 3 pounds, 4 ounces when I was born. I'm missing my right leg below the knee and several of my fingers and my big toe on my left foot.
Now Bowser is the president of the Children of Vietnam Veterans Health Alliance in Youngstown, Ohio.
Growing up with a Vietnam vet father and then having birth defects, living in a small town, not knowing anybody like me, had its challenges. And so as I've gotten older, I started reaching out looking for more kids of Vietnam vets and ended up creating a nonprofit organization that helps to focus on children of Vietnam veterans. We have about 5,000 people in a support group and other kids of Vietnam vets, and we work together to try to help support each other because the United States government doesn't recognize that children of male Vietnam veterans have been affected by their father's service. So there's many kids, but we're in our 40s and things now. I mean, we range from 28 to 50 years old, but so we have a range of problems, whether it's birth defects or chronic illness or cancers and all kinds of really horrible issues that a lot of people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Bowser says her parents didn't find out about her father's exposure to Agent Orange until after he returned from his tour of duty.
My parents actually found out on the Today Show when a Vietnam veteran who started the first lawsuit went on TV and said that I died in Vietnam and I didn't even know it. He was 28 years old and dying of stomach cancer. And that's how my parents found out, because my mother had had 2 miscarriages before me, and then I was born with all of my issues. And then after I was born, my mother had another miscarriage. And so they had no idea what had happened. My mom said to me that my dad felt guilty every time he saw me, because he felt like he was responsible. And that's really what we find in a lot of Vietnam vets. There's a lot of unresolved grief because they feel responsible when they had no responsibility in what had happened to them.
So when you put your organization together, was it easy to find people?
With social media, it's kind of easier to find people now, and that's really when this started, was at the very beginning of like Facebook and things like that and those online forums and things. I had first found a group that was founded by a Vietnam vet's wife, and she was kind of looking for kids, and I kind of started there. And then we branched off and started our own organization because the kids of Vietnam vets really haven't had their own voice. A lot of times, you know, we were considered the children of, but yet we're grown adults. And so trying to move out and try to build our own organization was really important.
So is it mostly just a support organization, or is there legal action?
First of all, with the first Agent Orange lawsuit, the Vietnam vets and their children were included in the suit. But then during the court hearing, the judge threw out the children's case. And so they just focused on settling the Vietnam veterans case. And so what happened is it kind of put us all in this kind of vacuum, let's say. So, for example, the Vietnam vets settled, and then they were, Monsanto or any of the chemical companies were no longer allowed to be held liable. They paid their money, that was done. And then we were still very young at that age, okay? So then they get through the lawsuit, and then all our dads get sick and die and have all these illnesses and cannot help to do this fight. And then the widows are taking care of their husbands, or the, you know, while their husbands are going through this illness, and then they're suffering and they're going through their grief. And the kids, we just kind of grow up and here we are, you know. So we had to take our mantle back and start looking for ways to try to get our cause out there. The issues are is that there's not been a lot of research because no one will fund the research, because the government absolutely does not want to admit that dioxin would cause issues in the children of male Vietnam veterans. There are 16 birth defects that are covered if you're a child of a female Vietnam veteran. And many, many of our birth defects, including my own, would be covered and acknowledged by the U.S. government if my mother was the Vietnam veteran. But there were only 7,500 women that served in Vietnam and over 2.8 million men that served. So if they admitted any kind of culpability, then that would be devastating financially. So there's a lot of that. So there hasn't been a lot of research. However, between Vietnam, between some of the other accidents that involved dioxin in the past, there is enough to kind of piece things together. And there has been, you know, leaks and things that say, yes, that birth defects are caused by dioxin exposure. But, again, not enough.
Heather Bowser is the president of the Children of Vietnam Veterans Health Alliance. You're listening to the Inland Journal podcast. Today we're hearing voices from last weekend's Veterans for Peace National Convention in Spokane. Another person at the convention who was not a Vietnam vet and yet is involved with that war's after effects is Ron Carver. He's a photographer from Washington, D.C., and the curator of a traveling exhibit of photographs that tell the stories of men and women who are anti-war activists while serving in the military. This version of Carver's exhibit received its first viewing at the Spokane Convention.
I spent 18 months working on creating an exhibit that covers all aspects of the GI movement. The people who refused to go, the people who left the country instead of going, those who marched in their uniforms, those who went to Vietnam and then refused to fight after one incident or another, those who went to Vietnam and took part but came back feeling betrayed and angry, and then joined in with other GIs to put out their own underground newspapers. There were all these different aspects of GI resistance. After 1968, every major peace march in the United States was led by active duty soldiers. We had hundreds marching. We had thousands marching. In 1968, 1,000 soldiers, active duty soldiers, marched in the streets of Killeen, Texas for peace. The next year, 1,000 Marines marched in Oceanside, California, outside of Camp Pendleton. I mean, huge numbers. But there aren't many historians who teach this, and so of course not many people know, and probably there's whole generations of historians who themselves don't know because they were never taught about this.
And that's part of the motivation behind a new book that Carver has co-edited. It's just being published. It's called Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Oppose the War. Carver and some of those who shared their stories in the book held a reception at the Spokane Conference. From here, he says he'll take his exhibit and the book back east to several universities.
One of the veterans who was hoping to be here in time to meet with you today, Mike Wong, who was from San Francisco and trained as a medic. Before it was time for him to go over, he tells a story, and it's in this exhibit. You can read it on a panel, that he was in a chow line at his military base, and he heard people saying, "Did you hear what happened? Did you hear what happened? They're killing women and children." And Mike Wong said, "Who's killing women and children? The Viet Cong?" And the word came back from the chow line, "No, we are." And the reason is that there was a newspaper stand right by the cash register, and there was a big headline talking about the My Lai massacre. And he said at that point, he didn't know what to do. So he went to, he's Chinese. He was based then in San Francisco. He goes to a Chinese theater. They're showing a movie about fighting between the Chinese and the Japanese, and the Japanese treating the Chinese terribly. And that crystallized it for him. And he said, well, here's my choice. Either I go to Vietnam and do to the Vietnamese what the Japanese did to the Chinese, or I go to Canada. And then he said, that's the hardest decision I ever made, is going to Canada, giving up my family, my friends, the culture that I know. But he felt he had to do it.
One of the men in Carver's book is Paul Cox. Cox served two tours of duty as a Marine in Vietnam. The first was near the demilitarized zone near the border separating the two Vietnams. He was fighting North Vietnamese soldiers. He says his second tour deeper in South Vietnam turned him against the war.
Our job, the 6 months I was there in that area, was to, we went into villages and we would round everybody up and we would put them on trucks and ship them off to a strategic hamlet, which was really kind of like a concentration camp. Tin roof shacks that they would build out in the middle of an open field with no shade, put barbed wire and gun towers around it. And the gates would be open during the day, but at night people were supposed to show up there to isolate them from the influence of the communists. And, you know, these people, we would give rice to the population. We'd give rice to the South Vietnamese government that was grown in California and Louisiana, but it wasn't the kind of rice they grew there. But a lot of it disappeared into the black market before it ever got down to these levels. So people were really driven into desperation, even if they were willing to live in those places. But they were also, you know, 15, 20 miles from their ancestral homes where their grandfather was buried. You know, they were in miserable conditions, and they lived in poverty. So very often people would leave and go back to their village. In the meantime, that village would have been declared a free fire zone, meaning just by living on their own land, they could be called an enemy, and if they got shot, nobody cared, which we did one day. And we walked into a village on April 15th, 1970, and the lead element said, Are there any friendlies in this area? And the captain sent the word back, no, this is a free fire zone. And the point squad opened up on these villagers and gunned them down, 15 people. And that was really a turning point for me.
After his six-month tour in South Vietnam, Paul Cox returned to the States to finish his military obligation. He was posted at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina.
And there were a number of anti-war Marines on the base there, and we started talking, and we decided after some discussion that we were going to print an underground newspaper, and if we printed the truth, we figured the Marine Corps would collapse. Still a little naive, perhaps, with a whole different headset, but we did that, and so for the last almost 2 years that I was in, we printed this underground newspaper. The name of it was Rage, which was an okay name. A better name would have been Rant, because I was the only one of our eight or nine guys that had any college, and I didn't know how to write. I hadn't learned how to write in school, and some of these guys hadn't even finished high school. But we were pissed off about what we had experienced in Vietnam, and we put out a newspaper that was an expression of that. And it was a very powerful, I mean, it exposed me to a lot of the anti-war movement, which this was 1971, 1972, you know, the anti-war movement in this country was in full bloom at that point, but I hadn't had any exposure to it, kid out of Oklahoma, and it really changed my life, and it actually probably saved my life because it gave me a way to channel my anger away from myself, which was substantial, to a more productive and peaceful way to behave.
So did your superiors know about this and tolerate it, or did they not know at all?
Well, they knew the paper was going out. It took them until just before I got out for them to figure out who I was. I mean, we were publishing this thing off camp away in Chapel Hill, and then we would come on base at middle of the night and pass them around through the barracks. And usually these barracks are supposed to have a fire watch, supposed to keep somebody awake so that somebody doesn't burn the place down. And sometimes the fire watch would be awake, and he'd go, hey, what are you doing? And he'd say, well, here, read this. And we'd keep going, and we'd go. By the time we hit the back door, we'd do this, yeah, far out, man. But eventually, you know, after doing several barracks like this, we'd start seeing the MPs start to wake up. Somebody would turn us in, and we'd say, okay, that's enough for tonight, and we'd scoot.
Paul Cox published an anti-war newspaper as a Marine in North Carolina in the early 1970s. On one of Ron Carver's photo exhibits about anti-war military members, he tells the story of Susan Schnall. In 1968, Schnall was a U.S. Navy nurse based in San Francisco. She cared for wounded soldiers sent back from Vietnam.
I felt that I had become a part of the military machine and that I needed to speak out as a member of the armed forces. So I joined with a group called the GI and Veterans March for Peace. We were planning a demonstration on October 12, 1968 in San Francisco. And we had difficulty getting publicity out. We would put posters up around the hospital, around military bases, and they would be taken down almost immediately. There was, at that point, no internet, no Facebook, no Instagram. I had seen that the United States dropped flyers on the Vietnamese in South Central Vietnam, urging the Vietnamese to go to protected hamlets. And I thought, if the United States can drop these flyers 8,000 miles away, why can't we put flyers together announcing the demonstration and drop them on military bases in the San Francisco Bay Area? So these are the flyers that we had that announced the demonstration for October 12th. On October 10th, I had a friend who was a pilot, and we filled up this small one-engine plane with flyers that we then dropped on Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, on the Presidio, on Treasure Island, on Yerba Buena Island, and then we flew into Alameda Naval Air Station, where an aircraft carrier was docked, and we dropped the flyers on the aircraft carrier. We then came back to Palo Alto Airport, and I held a press conference wearing my uniform and spoke out against the war. Again, I felt that I was representing other folks in the military who also were against the United States involvement in Southeast Asia. And then we had the demonstration in San Francisco that was on a Saturday. And as you can see, I wore my Navy uniform in that demonstration. And then I was tried by general court-martial in 1969 for conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentlewoman for dropping the flyers on military bases. And what the military said is that that was going to be harming loyalty and morale. And my defense was, no, it doesn't. It says to people in the military, you can take a stand opposite to the one that your government has, and you can take that position and say, no, I don't agree with you. And you can say that, and you can survive. And it's important for the American public to hear us. And then the second charge was for wearing my uniform in a political demonstration, speaking out publicly. My defense was that if General Westmoreland could go in front of Congress and request additional troops and additional money to fight a war, why couldn't I, as a member of the armed forces, wear my uniform for peace? And that's what I did. The military did not agree. So they found me guilty of both charges and gave me a sentence of 6 months confinement at hard labor, dismissal from the service, and forfeiture of all pay and allowances. The one question that I have never changed my position on is whether I would have done it again. And the answer absolutely is yes, that I went into nursing to take care of people and help them feel better and get back into society. And what I saw the military doing was destroying lives.
50 years after that event, Susan Schnall is affiliated with Veterans for Peace. She was in Spokane last weekend for the organization's national convention. And so is a man who only had to drive about 90 miles to get here. We finish this Inland Journal podcast by spending a few minutes with a former prisoner of war in Vietnam. Bob Chenoweth was an Oregon native who now lives in Moscow, Idaho. Chenoweth was a helicopter crew chief who served two tours of duty, including the time when the North Vietnamese launched the Tet Offensive.
The 7th of February, my helicopter was posted to go up to the northern part of South Vietnam for 3 days and fly some support missions. And on the 8th of February, coming back from the first day of flying, we were hit by small arms fire from people we call the Viet Cong, the liberation forces. So the helicopter caught fire in the air, There was an explosion. We crashed in a cemetery, and within about an hour, we were all rounded up and captured by the people that shot us down.
Chenoweth was okay. Two people aboard his helicopter were hurt, one of them badly burned. The captors took their prisoners and headed up into the mountains, where they met another prisoner there. They would travel some more, stay in mountain guerrilla camps, and then get up and travel again.
And we came up on a pathway that had ruts in it, and it turned out to be a branch of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And from that time, we began riding trucks at night. So we rode trucks for about 2 weeks to get up into Nghệ An province.
The march continued, with Chenoweth's captors continuing to pick up prisoners, until finally they arrived at a place where they'd stay for a couple of years.
It was kind of like a prison camp, but not very much like a prison camp, like not like you think of in the movies. And we left there in November of 1970 after the Americans tried to mount a commando raid to recover prisoners.
Overall, Chenoweth was held as a prisoner of war for about 5.5 years.
How were you treated during your time with them?
I was treated well.
Were you beaten?
I got into a couple of fights with guards, but I wasn't beaten up to try to get information from me or anything like that.
Tortured or anything?
No. I mean, well, what did I know? They knew what we knew. There wasn't anything a soldier on the battlefield in Vietnam could tell the Vietnamese about what was going on. They knew.
When Chenoweth came back, he was a critic of the war.
My time in Vietnam before I was a prisoner convinced me that, first of all, we were not going to win because the people didn't support us. The people didn't like us. And what we learned in training was to be afraid of the Vietnamese. So not to see them as our allies or people we were trying to help, but to be wary of them, to be cautious, because any one of them could kill you. So when you go with that kind of fear and stuff starts happening, you can do anything, and we did. So there was a lot of that I witnessed myself, but it didn't always make sense to me.
Bob Chenoweth now lives in Moscow, Idaho. He was at the Witness for Peace National Convention in Spokane last weekend. You can see pictures of him and others whom we interviewed for this story, in addition to other images related to the event, at the Spokane Public Radio website. You can subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast at Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play. Your comments and story ideas are always welcome at inlandjournal@kpbx.org. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Thank you for joining us.